Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host for Love, Lust, and Laughter. There is a wonderful book called The Sex and Pleasure Book, Good Vibrations Guide to Great Sex for Everyone. And fortunately, I have the main author of this book, Dr. Carol Queen, as my guest, not only for this show, but for next week's show. We'll do a part two on October the 3rd, so stay tuned. Welcome to this program, Dr. Carol Queen.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be with you, Diana.
Well, you know, we have actually known each other a long time, but we hadn't seen each other until Catalyst Con, and that was last month. Well, actually, no, earlier this month, because we're still in September. And so it was really good to see you again, and I bought your book, and you signed it. I love the way you signed the book. Let me just get to that page here. You said, Diana, let's fill the world with pleasure. XO Carol Queen. And I wanted to quote, there's one of the quotes, the previous program on Progressive Radio Network, you might have heard a little bit of it, was about war, and Emily Nagoski, PhD, author of Come As You Are, she's one of the people quoted on the back cover of your book, and she says, this is the one, an inclusive, compassionate, funny, and comprehensive guide to being human, with both a brain and genitals. If everyone, everywhere, read this book, we'd probably have world peace. I agree with that. And
that
instead of fighting, we'd be giving each other more massages and orgasms.
Well, you know, actually, as you well know, Diana, within the ranks of sexologists, when we get together and we just start throwing ideas around at each other, it's not unusual to hear sexuality professionals talk about the effect that repression and shame and general sex negativity has on people, and with the assumption that some of what's wrong with the world is connected to those things. Whether it would stop all war, I don't know. There's still, I suppose there would still be natural resources to fight over and so forth, but the part where people get way too upset at each other and call each other enemies, if people were masturbating more, I'm sure I'm not the first person that you've heard say this, maybe it would make a difference. And I'm not trying to make light of this question.
No, I know you're not.
War, but we do think that shame and repression has bad social effects. We believe it wholeheartedly, you know?
Yes, and at the beginning of your book, you have you've written that most of us weren't given an operating manual for our wonderful bodies and the myriad sensations we can experience with them, especially not in sex education classes we took in school. Can you imagine if driver's ed consisted of a teacher saying, here's a car, now don't drive it? And you say, that's the way much sex education is currently taught. What a shame. What a shame. And that's such a good point. I wanted the listeners to know that Dr. Carol Queen and I are going to be talking about three topics today, and in the East Coast it's this evening. The term sex positive, sexual orientation issues, and transgender identities. And this show is now 7 years old, and I haven't really focused on these topics very much, so I look forward to that. And we'll see what we get through, and we've got a part two coming up. So that's all great. Your history with Good Vibrations goes back 25 years, right? Even more now.
Even a little longer than that now, about 27 and a half. Yeah, I've been here almost half of my entire life, which is such an extraordinary thing. I don't think I knew that was going to happen when I took a one-day-a-week job that Joni Blank offered to me in 1990, but here we all are.
Yep. And I have a history with good vibrations myself, both for myself and for some clients. And because I lived in Palo Alto for a number of years.
Yes.
Back in 1991, I was, this was right after I'd done a series for older sexuality, and I had a group of older women, and they came to me after this series at the Senior Center in Palo Alto, and this was at Christmas time, and I remember distinctly they're leaving my office one afternoon, and they were all giggling because they were going to do a field trip to Good Vibrations. And in those days, you didn't even have an office in Palo Alto. That didn't come until 2013, right?
Right.
Yeah. But you did have one. The first one was on Mission, is that right?
Well, at that point, it would have been at 23rd and Valencia.
Oh, that's
right. That was the
first
store where I worked, yes. And so in the Mission District in San Francisco, yes, for sure. Because initially, 40 years ago, when Joni Blank founded Good Vibes, that was sort of the women's neighborhood. There were women's bookstores and coffee houses. There was a lesbian bar. The women's building is there. So Joni wanted to be near the women who she presumed would be the first most logical customers for her female-friendly, female-focused store. And now, of course, we're friendly and focused on everyone, everybody of every orientation and gender identity. But Joni did start Good Vibrations for women. There's no question about that. So this group of older women and you, did you come along on their field trip?
I did not, but I got a report back, and they came back with sex toys for themselves and even to give to others at Christmas time. They were so excited.
That's delightful. I remember early in my tenure there, working on the sales floor, a woman who was pushing 80 anyway, she may even have been a little older than that, came in, stepped up to me and said she wanted to buy a vibrator, and then what she said next just struck me. It changed my life a little bit, I think, that she said this to me. She said, "I just don't want to die without ever having had an orgasm."
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I know. Isn't that, it's kind of a tearjerker, right?
Yes.
And I sold her a magic wand, and I can only hope that she had many happy returns with that with that item. So many people love that vibrator, but that's a lot of responsibility to help someone choose a vibrator under those circumstances.
Oh, that's so true. So before I moved to Seattle 9 years ago, I worked at UCLA's Female Sexual Medicine Center, obviously in Los Angeles. And what we discovered there is that if women had not masturbated as teenagers up until maybe their early 20s, that probably the neural pathways between the genitals and the brain had not been established. And so these women almost always needed a vibrator in order to reach orgasm. They needed more stimulation than their own fingers or their partner's fingers or mouth or penis could provide in order to reach orgasm. And probably this 80-year-old woman had not masturbated.
Right, right.
And that's a wouldn't you agree that's pretty important for...
I would agree that that's pretty important, and I also think that neural pathways aside, and we I think still don't even know enough about that very innate form of responsiveness. Some people have studied it, but there's not a lot of support in high level research to study sexuality in the ways that we sexologists really think it ought to be.
Oh, absolutely.
There's not as much good research as I would like to cite. I imagine you feel that way, too, sometimes.
I think absolutely.
About what you said, I also think about the fact that this is also the time frame when young people are getting usually fairly terrible sex education, and that's the that's the, whether they're being, you know, made afraid to drive their car or not. Mm-hmm. When I speak to groups of college students, I ask how many of them think they had excellent sex education, and once in a while, a couple of them will slink their hands in the air. Usually, most of them sensibly know that no, they really didn't have good sex education. But generally, the couple of people who do feel that they got good sex education put their hands down again when I ask them, "Were you taught about the role of the clitoris?"
Right.
You know, not in, occasionally, yes. But then I find out that they're a Unitarian or a Scandinavian or someone who probably did really get better sex ed than most of us in the United States get. And I think that one of the things that fires up sexologists in training is not only to help others around sexuality, obviously that's a mission that we have, but just how little we learn officially and how exciting it is to fill in all of those gaps of knowledge, right?
Absolutely. My daughter lives in Canada and is married to a Canadian, and she gave me a magazine that's similar, it seems to me, to The Atlantic here in the U.S. It's called The Walrus, and there is a wonderful article in it that I have since copied and made available for a few of my clients because I do bibliotherapy, and it's called The Pleasure Principal, P-A-L, and it talks about Meredith Cheever's and Lori Brato's research in Canada. Now, the difference is that in Canada, they can get research money for studying sexual pleasure. If pleasure is a part of any study, as you know, in the United States, it doesn't get accepted. Only problem sexes get.
Unless
we don't have enough money
seeking
for pleasure.
Seeking to sell us drugs. That's the place where such research might live in the United States, but otherwise, absolutely right.
Yes, yes. So I promised the listeners that we are going to talk about sex positivity, and you say that it is not addressed. Sometimes people think of it as just sex positive as being enthusiastic, and so in your opening statements in your book, the Sex and Pleasure book, it's so comprehensive. I just love this book. You say that sex positivity, you say, is a call to action, determined to help make this perspective more widely available, because negative messages can be so insidious. And so would you talk a little more about consent and healing from shame and all of those things that are really important?
Sure. Well, depending on what kind of company your listeners keep, they really may have heard this term sex positive recently. It's getting much more used out in mainstream media and so forth. There was a time when if you weren't a sexologist or an activist of some kind in the sexuality world, you just wouldn't hear this phrase. And I dated back to the late 1980s when it started to gradually get out of its corral, whoever theorized it in the first place. But now, and I really think this is a symptom of how simplistic we're taught to think about sexuality. It really does seem to people that it must mean that people think, yay, sex, and are sort of boosters and cheerleaders And the really unfortunate part of that is the idea that if somebody isn't having enough sex, that they feel as though sex positivity denigrates them in some way. The asexual people may think that they don't have anything to gain by thinking in these terms. But really, sex positivity wants to open the door to respect for everyone's consensual sexuality, whatever it may be, and to state that we all have a right to education, to health services, to an upbringing and a cultural context and community that doesn't shame us for being who we are. Because this question of shame, I mean, as a As a therapist, I know you must have seen the effects of it time and time again. If we are shamed about touching ourselves or who we love or what we want to do or having too much sex or having too little sex or the wrong, whatever it may be, it's hard to establish a sense of that we deserve pleasure, that we deserve
that it is our birthright.
Find love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That it is our birthright, that yeah. it's everyone's birthright as long as they can figure out a way to do it consensually. And
yes,
our upbringing and our sex education that so often makes sex seem like it's dangerous unless you really learn how to navigate it, and then they don't really teach you how to navigate it, mainly just not to drive the car.
Not to drive the car.
It's fundamentally in danger of shaming many of the people that we're educating, because if we don't get the sexuality that we aspire to or already experienced talked about as though it's okay, then... What are the alternatives to that? You know, in this culture, so many people are shamed and called out for so many different kinds of things. And so that's one thing I think we all deserve to live free from shame. And whether that means ending slut shaming and other kinds of bullying, whether that means being more sort of body positive and sex positive about child rearing. And I don't, all I mean by that is, being honest with young people about their bodies and what things are called and that they have control over the decision-making process of saying no as well as expressing interest. That this, it's not rocket science and it's not, you know, crossing a line that most people don't want to cross. It's just that the elements of shaming and negativity really are everywhere, and it's hard to avoid them altogether when you're parenting a child, when you're taking care of kids as a teacher, just when you're growing up and trying to explore yourself.
I really believe that sexuality should be a shame-free zone, that there's no need to be ashamed or embarrassed about our bodies, our desires, even our fantasies, or maybe solo sex or our erotic connections with others.
Right.
I just so believe that we're entitled to do as we please, so long as it's consensual, and you mm-hmm. highlight that big time in your book, that we have to adhere to consent. And
well, part of the reason that consent is so important mm-hmm. is that, and it's like shame, freedom from shame in this sense, too, that if someone isn't in charge of their own desires and their own body, enjoying their natural ability to enjoy sex and love and everything else
mm-hmm.
gets affected. If someone is messed with by others in some way, whether it's in a shaming kind of a context or a mm-hmm. I'm going to take what I want or you're too drunk to remember or whatever it
mm-hmm.
might be,
mm-hmm.
We're affected in our ability to say, I am okay, this is me, this is mine, I will share it with whom I want, and I don't have to do anything I don't want to do. And, of course, once people get into ongoing relationships, whether they're monogamous or not, people in relationships sometimes who don't even understand that they can say yes and say no when their, you know, their bodies dictate. And even in a relationship where you're supposed to be safe, it can be hard to understand that you deserve consensual experiences all the time. So just beginning to talk about this is the very first step. I remember when I came to San Francisco, began my PhD process, even before I worked at Good Vibrations, although I got right in on the ground floor here, too.
Yes, you did.
Even so, I did not hear about consent anywhere.
You did not. So this
BDSM
goes back community. To 1990,
no,
right?
When we were growing up, that wasn't part of the sex ed. Not at mm-hmm. all. In the BDSM world, I heard the word consent again and again.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, when you're going to do all kinds of wild and crazy things, you want to make sure that the people all want to do them. That makes perfect sense. But when you're going to do vanilla sex of any kind, touch another body, you want to make sure that everybody wants to do it, too. It's not just hanging from the chandelier that we need consent for. It's all experience. And when people can trust that they and their partners are in agreement with what they're exploring and experiencing, what a weight off our mind, you know? I can't imagine that the people who are taking advantage of opportunities that might not be seen as consensual if someone else were doing the calling out, that can't be great sex. For the most part, that's not something you can carry through into a relationship and know that you can count on it. So I know that people are going to have better sex when more of us can be assured of having consensual sex. I know it.
There was an article in one of the sexual journals, well, it probably is a couple of years ago now, that pointed out that BDSM practitioners, a lot of people assume that they're not really healthy emotionally, and that's wrong,
right?
Because they take the time to have conversations about what they do want to do and what they don't want to do, and so their communication is really good.
Yes, and regardless of whatever background a person comes from, it gets them interested in kinky fantasies and experience. You know, the mind wanders, doesn't it? I mean, a lot of us are armchair travelers about traveling, but we fantasize and are armchair travelers about sexuality and sensation and pleasure and excitement, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that I think vanilla sex practitioners don't necessarily understand about people in BDSM, is that it's a way of opening up possibility and finding safe ways and agreed upon and negotiated ways to have outrageous experiences that might be difficult to have unless you have those communication skills and willing partners and partners interested in doing that exploring with you. So I think even those of us who don't play BDSM games ever can learn a lot from the way that community thinks about and communicates about sexuality and pleasure.
I agree with you. And, you know, remembering that we have autonomy and freedom with regard to our sexuality, and no one can tell us what we can or can't do so long as our behavior is responsible and ethical. And we can learn from BDSM people about, you know, clear communication and setting down the boundaries and the rules for what will happen and what won't happen in a sexual encounter.
It's such a liberating thing to be able to actually say what it is you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think about how many people haven't ever had that opportunity, even people who've had pretty great sex their whole lives,
mm-hmm.
sometimes haven't ever just spoken up about what their desires are, putting it to words in the first place, is something of a taboo. We don't learn how to do that. It's not modeled to us for the most part.
Yeah.
And it's liberating, and it is a sex positive act all by itself for someone to say what it is they desire, be heard or witnessed by someone else, whether you're doing it in a support group or in bed with your person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have in your book some under the chapter sex positivity, a number of, and we've already touched on some of the what it is, and but I especially like the non-judgmental, or at least including an awareness of and control over our judgments. You know, sometimes we come out of families of origin that have been very critical and judgmental, and sometimes there are also religious beliefs that have stuck, even if the person has left the church.
Yes.
But they linger, and so, or especially, too, if there's been some sexual trauma in
yes.
one's youth. So that can really, and of course I see these people and we often work through so that the person can say, yeah, I want my sex life to be, as you put it in the book, pleasure inclusive, and and
I think almost everyone wants to have a good sex life, whatever that means to them. I mean, even asexual people have a sense of what they do and don't want to experience, whether they want intimacy and love but not a sex act or whatever it may be. And there's nobody sitting around saying, I want my sex life to be worse than it is right now.
Oh, that's right.
You know, that's just not how we roll. Even if we don't think we deserve it, even if we don't think we'll ever get it, any of that, people would still, I think, be grateful and so relieved if they knew that the experiences they had around sexuality for the rest of their life would be pleasant and pleasurable.
Pleasant and
great.
Yeah, and the sex education, ongoing education, is essential, as you say in your book. And, you know, really, this program, Love, Lust, and Laughter, in great part is dedicated to ongoing sexual education. And now I get to have a guest like you that can give us so much more. And maybe this is a good time to go on to, unless you have something else you'd like to say about sex positivity.
No, I think let's step on to our next topic, because of course it's all included under
it's all,
the
and it's all interrelated, isn't it?
Idea anyway, isn't it? It's you know, when we talk about differences in sexual orientation and things like that, that's certainly one of the elements that a more sex positive society would be able to go far toward helping people who don't feel respected in their identity able to just feel whole about this.
Yes. So let's then talk about sexual orientation issues. And, you know, I had a client recently, a male client, and he said that he'd been toying with the idea of letting another man touch him. He always had thought of himself as a heterosexual. And he wondered, does this mean that I'm gay? And I said, it may, but it probably doesn't. That many men are curious about how it would feel to be stimulated by another man. And this curiosity is reinforced by the fact that masturbation is frequently more satisfying than for a number of men than intercourse or oral sex. And I think that can be tied in with porn viewing and masturbation, but that's another topic.
Right.
So I don't know how you feel about it, Carol, but I think that sexual orientation is usually developed during childhood, and gay people generally discover their homosexuality before the age of 21. Many people, however, worry about it to the point where their thoughts about homosexuality are disrupting their lives, even though they're heterosexual. And so I usually say, don't judge your thoughts and eroticism. Enjoy the fantasies and act in whatever way makes sense to you. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And
yes.
And I think you're speaking to him about the question of curiosity is a really valuable way to think about it, because that really is the driver of so many people's different kinds of sexual experience. Well, what would that be like? How do I know if I want to do it if I've never tried it? And
yes,
that makes logical sense in many ways, right? I mean, there's the inborn or very, very early established, depending on who you you know, whose theories you think about and agree with the most.
Yeah.
A question of who you're drawn to and what you're drawn to doing. And I also really want to point out to people that two things about this topic. One, we talk about sexual orientation as though it's defined by the kind of sex that people have, when really it's defined by the gender of the person that we want to have the sex with.
Good point.
If a
say more about
that. Man is attracted to another man. Mm-hmm. He's expressing gay or bisexual attraction because he may not leave behind any attraction he might have felt for women. We don't exactly have correct language to talk about desiring somebody who is a gender non-binary person in this sort of gay, straight, bi language that we have developed. But certainly that doesn't mean that there aren't people opening their hearts and bedroom doors to gender non-binary people all the time, too.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea that so one of the things that your client might have been concerned about underneath is, if I let a man touch my penis and I explore the sensation that might give me, does that mean that I'm going to move on to anal sex? You know,
mm-hmm.
Am I going to quote-unquote turn gay? And that would mean that then I would be doing those other things. When, in fact, a study a while ago, I don't remember exactly how long ago it was, I even read the study, but more heterosexual married women had anal sex than gay men, percentage-wise.
That's interesting.
That's not the primary.
More women had. Of course, I've seen gay couples.
It's not the primary act. The primary sex act, when you say the majority of people of that orientation and that gender mainly are doing oral and manual sex. And anal is something that many people love very much, but it isn't just gay men. And then people say, well, but the prostate gland, and that's true. The prostate gland may be stimulated that way, and it may feel lovely. And there are plenty of heterosexual men with sex toys or female partners with strap-ons exploring that, too, and it hasn't changed their sexual orientation because they don't want to have that kind of experience with another man, because that is what homosexuality is. It's not the act. It's the gender of the person that you do the act with. Every person of every gender has a menu of things they could do sexually. And, you know, if there's not a penis and a vagina in the room, you're not going to have penis-vagina sex today. But generally, people's sex lives are more alike than they are different across sexual orientation. And I think in the United States, we barely understand that. For some reason, it's thinking of other people as so different from us, when in reality, there are similarities and differences always.
And the studies seem to show that female sexuality is more fluid, that women can be aroused by watching two men having sex,
mm-hmm.
two women mm-hmm. having sex, seeing mm-hmm. bonobo monkeys having sex.
Yes.
So there's a lot of fluidity, it seems from the studies, more among women than among men, and they can get aroused.
That's right, and it's so interesting to speculate about what that might have to do with, because it could be so many different things. It could be that, some people posit that women's sexuality is indeed simply more fluid. There's
mm-hmm.
more possibilities mm-hmm. For pleasure and different ways of getting there and getting aroused by different things. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Some people posit that because women's sexuality is not talked about very specifically, and more now, of course, than ever before, probably in history, but nevertheless, it's very easy to be a girl or a young woman and not hear a whole lot about female sexual pleasure and specific kinds of sexual information. So then there's a sort of gap that young women have to across before they get to a place where they can really learn a lot about sex, where it's okay to do so. And in that absence of talk about what female sexuality specifically looks like, that's where all this fluidity comes in. You know, it's like, you know, women our age and older will say, well, I knew about all that. I grew up on a farm. And maybe that's what the pictures of the bonobos are standing in for.
Yeah, that's true. Although when I was in my 20s, I remember looking for information. I'm a bit older than you are, and there wasn't enough information when I was in my 20s, and I went looking. And thank goodness that we have more information, and your book provides, it's so complete. And I just would encourage people to get this book. They can find it on Amazon.com or what?
Or at the Good Vibrations website, goodvibes.com. If you enter sex and pleasure book in the little search bar, you'll find it that way. If you're reading on your device, then Amazon is the best bet. But if you like a paper book with pages to turn to put on the shelf, then it's available there or through Good Vibrations, or you can ask your local bookstore if they would order it.
Exactly. And so you mentioned goodvibes.com and then also you have carolqueen.com, and I'll put all of
right,
this
that's
in
my
a summary.
Right, that's my personal website, which doesn't change as much as some people's. I'm not a super frequent blogger and so forth, but there's a fair amount of material on there that people might find interesting.
Absolutely. I saw a video of you saying, bust a sex myth, and that you pointed out that 70% of women do not have orgasms with intercourse, and that is a big myth.
That's right. And just last month, some of the people who are doing good sex research in the United States, Debbie Herbenick and some of the folks at Indiana University around the Kinsey Institute and so forth, released their study about outer course being better than intercourse at helping some women to orgasm, which is, of course, not at all surprising. What they're talking about especially is, you know, external body touch and especially clitoral touch. And in this world where we think that there are only two sexes and they're opposites, which drives me mad.
Of course.
We're not opposites. That language just alienates us from one another, and we share so many more things than we are opposite in. If people with penises that usually orgasm from having contact with their penis by hand or other pleasurable method tried to have an orgasm without actually touching their penis, they would have a harder time.
Exactly.
And the penis and the clitoris are homologous, and they work essentially the same way.
Yeah, yes, and a lot of people don't know that, and you show that in your book.
We had a wonderful artist.
Yes.
Do our illustrations. She's such a wonderful illustrator, and we said, all right, well, you're doing these cute illustrations of people having different kinds of sex, but would you copy this medical chart now, please? And she did.
Yeah.
So people can sort of understand how our different gendered bodies develop in utero. Of course, it's not one way or the other. There are intersex people, too, and people who, as they grow older, don't identify with the gender that they were assigned at birth, and sometimes we call those folks trans. But
and that's maybe a good segue to the third topic that we were going to cover today about transgender people. And, you know, your book is so refreshing because you have information for transgender people. It's hard to come across.
If you're not already in the community, if you're not already, in the web circles where people help each other by giving each other information, you know, who's the right doctor to go and talk to, How do I expect my body's going to change when I begin hormones? Or just imagine if somebody is trans and are going to do anything to alter their body via hormones or any other way. Just, when we started talking about how many questions people have after a essentially poor sex education in this country, imagine the questions. Imagine the information that has to be gathered in order for people to make the right decisions for themselves. So for a long time at Good Vibrations, we've tried not to live in a completely binary world. Many of us are trans or gender non-binary. Many of our lovers and partners and spouses have been, and so we just know, and our customers too, of course, we just know how important that is when people have questions about sex or gender. There needs to be a safe place to go, and so we try to weave that insight into this book as much as we could. You do such a good job of it,
including on page 415 in your book, talking about trans parents. And one of the couples I'm seeing are parents to a six-year-old trans kid who started out as a boy but has known since she was three that she was a girl, just born in the wrong body. And the wonderful thing is that here in Seattle, which is an amazing resource-rich community, at Swedish Hospital, there is a group for trans parents, in other words, parents of trans children, and also a group for the children. And I think,
fantastic.
These are amazing resources, and it normalizes the thing, which so many, you know, just a few years ago, there, of course, the suicide rate is very high among trans people. And so it's important to have these resources.
I think access to information and support is crucial. I want to clarify, as we're talking about this topic, that I'm not trans-identified myself, but I certainly want to be an ally. And I certainly know that any of us can choose to find out more, learn more. It's up to us to educate ourselves. It's not up to us to, you know, quiz people about what's in their pants and how it got there. They have other things on their mind than educating us and all the fine points of all the things that you know, folks are still thinking about their own options. We don't need to be causing others to stop what they're doing and educate us, but being an ally is something that this year, as we were just beginning to really feel as though the polity was making a space for our trans neighbors, now things are much more dire for them again. And I just think we need to be conscious of the human toll that takes, and remember that in a community that takes these issues seriously, sexuality, gender identity, we're learning more from each other all the time than we ever learned in these terribly truncated sex ed courses. There are a lot of interesting things in this world, and sex and gender are two of them. They're interesting, and it makes me feel so sad when people are reactive and sort of old-fashioned about these issues, because they've been taught to be. You know, that's mainly the reason. They've come up in some kind of a community that has certain ideas that they continue to perpetuate, and I just think, if you could just get out of that box where you are right now, you would find so many fascinating things to explore and to think about. I am in so many ways a better person by living in an inclusive community the way that I do. I am thankful for it every single day.
Boy, you say it so well, Carol, and I'm on the same page. So I just wanted to interject a pretty fascinating study, so about sexual orientation and maybe even transgender. There's been a lot written about this, but in terms of the biological factors. But researchers, here's one study that I found fascinating. Researchers have injected sheep with hormones that cause male-type behaviors. And so the female offspring of these sheep turned out to be stud muffin lambs who displayed stereotypical male behaviors. And other researchers have claimed that there are different structures in the human brain, and then, you know, for gay and homosexual and heterosexual people. But again, we don't really have the research money in the United States to study these things the way we should. But I think that's fascinating that, you know, they can study it with sheep.
Well, there certainly is more ability to do animal studies about a variety of these kinds of issues, partly because you don't have to ask the sheep to go out and sign a release.
That's right.
Hard to experiment on them. And, you know, my first degree is in sociology, but I came a little late to sexology. I went ahead and got a degree in sociology first, and it really helps me come at sex. You know, I call myself a cultural sexologist often, and that's a phrase that I made up out of whole cloth because I wanted people to see me as looking at the big pictures, the movements, the cultural change, all of that kind of stuff, rather than expecting me to come out in a white coat and offer to put a cuff around their penis and measure their blood flow, which also sounds like fun, but that's not the kind of sexologist that I am. So when I hear about the research, it just makes me so desire to live only just for a minute in a culture that honored this so important element of human experience with some good research, with more good research, because there is some good research, but much more good research where I don't understand that everyone isn't a person who is curious about knowing as much as they can about these things, that there are some people who are our neighbors who appear not very curious about it at all. Just mystifies me. I imagine they're mystified right back at me, but I think that this is the kind of thing that helps illustrate that notion we started with, sex positivity and its converse, sex negativity, because really it is a form of sex negativity not to be able to find the resources or the support or the permission to do good research in a science context. These days there's all kinds of scientists that are worried about their next paycheck, I suppose.
But
I would love it if we all turned in one direction and said, let's try to really understand this. And let's realize that sheep will only get us so far in our understanding.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, there's a lot of ways you can't experiment on humans, of course. I'm not suggesting that we do that, but I'm also saying that there are many things we could be trying to delve into that don't get their due the way things are now. And I hope that will change someday.
I do too, because sex, if we know more about it and we have a more positive attitude, it can be a way of, and I've seen this in the 35 years I've been doing this work, that sex can be a way of working through our fears and crises, and it can also be a place for growth and forgiveness and fun and friendship. And so I'm a real cheerleader for sex, for good sex at any age. And
right.
Yeah, and here I am a senior, and I've bragged about this before on this show, but I have a wonderful partner who happens to also be my fiancé, where I feel like the sex that we have, which is so robust and so wonderful, is my that it helps me stay young. It's and healthy.
That's
and
right.
As I said before, you know, it's a way. It can be for growth and fun and friendship. It can bond you so much more. But anyway, I feel very grateful for that. And you've had a long-term partner, and I have. I didn't get to see him at Catalyst Con except from a distance, but I remember him from some years ago. Robert.
Yes.
You've had a long-time partnership with Robert.
Yes, we've been, it hasn't been quite 30 years, but we're going to get there, I think. In another couple of years. And another thing that you didn't mention, but you sort of almost touched on when you said what you just said, is the way that sex can help someone who is experiencing chronic pain or other of physical challenge in a body that changes. And my partner is disabled now. The pleasure that you can get from solo sex or partner sex can be extremely important. And that's another. I don't know, another way to relate back to the idea of sexual fluidity. I mean, the young people are talking about pansexuality and that can mean a variety of things, but one of the things it means is not only being binary in your interests and desires. It's pansexuality is used sort of like bisexuality, only some think that bi is too binary now. But it can also reference sexual fluidity and the fact that our sexuality can change over time, that it isn't static and entirely stable for everyone, that even people whose sexual desires don't change over the span of their life might find that their body changes, and so their sexual desires may wind up taking a little bit of a different effect, right? Mm-hmm. Different shape. And I certainly know that from my adventure with Robert, and it's such an important thing to reassure people, I think, that even if their health status changes, that doesn't mean that their ability to be intimate goes away. The more you're open to exploring what's possible in the body you have this year as opposed to the body you had 20 years ago, probably the more pleasure you'll have.
That's such an important point, Carol. I'm so glad you've made it, that we should not compare our 60-year-old self with our 30-year-old self. And of course, the big message here is that sex does not equal intercourse. That's why I get my clients to use the word intercourse, because I think of sex as so much more than penis and vagina, right?
Right. And if that's all we define sex as, then it becomes a much bigger deal if for some reason we can't have it or don't have a partner to have it with. But it also means, especially for cis women who were assigned female at birth, or, you know, basically anybody with a clitoris, depending on how they identify, that if the definition of sex is vaginal insertion, then you run the risk of ignoring the things that allow you to get turned on enough for that to be pleasurable and orgasmic. And that's one of the reasons that people have such challenges with orgasm and with chronic sexual pain, too. That's not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons, is that simply people don't pay enough attention to all the rest of the body that helps you get into the space where vaginal insertion, or anal insertion for that matter, feels good. And I don't think many people understand that there is something they could be doing differently to add to their pleasure, but it doesn't start at the opening of the vagina. It starts practically at the top of their head. You know,
well,
that's
yes.
part of the... And if they don't think of it as sex, then of course they might give it short shrift in favor
yeah.
of running right to the what they define as sex.
So one of the exercises that I give to many of my new couples who are having problems, it's usually the woman with a lower desire, but not always. But anyway,
always.
With mismatched desire, I give them sensate focus or caressing exercises. And
yes.
Masters and Johnson came up with the term sensate focus because they felt that, and I know you know this, but some of the listeners may not, that too much attention for many people is placed on the genitals. And there are all these
mm-hmm.
other possibilities from the top of our head to the bottom of our toes, these
mm-hmm.
erotic possibilities for pleasure. So these exercises that don't even allow intercourse the first couple of times can be very illuminating for people. And then if a guy is having trouble with erectile dysfunction or premature ejaculation, then when intercourse is taken off the table, so to speak, then he can feel so much more relaxed. And isn't that the truth, that when we're relaxed, and we have much better sex when we're not all tied up with performance anxiety and stuff.
Much more pleasure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's so common for people to get up in their head and worry
mm-hmm.
about how they look, about how they'll respond, about whether they'll keep their erection, or about whether they've got wet enough, whatever it is. And though that degree of worry almost guarantees that they will have a problem.
That's
at
right.
At least getting to orgasm. I mean, it's
yep.
almost it's almost like a prescription for having a bad or a worse time than they otherwise would have.
And that's
so. I hope that people will get out of their heads when they find themselves getting in them. That's what sensate focus is good for too.
That's so true. And you know, I work with Microsoft and Amazon people here in Seattle, and a lot of these they're mainly guys, but not always, but they're in their heads a lot because they're programming.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
it's really hard to get out of their fucking heads. Oh, that's our music. So luckily we have Carol Queen next week. So thank you, Carol. Thanks
thank
so much.
You, Diana.
And we'll talk more next week. Goodbye, everybody.
That's right.